Today's program was brought to you by Hungry Root. Clean ingredient, nutrient-dense food that's on your plate in under 10 minutes. Hungry Root makes eating healthy easy with fresh, pre-prepared ingredients that turn into delicious, nutritionally balanced meals in minutes. Hungry Root is healthy food for life. For more information, visit hungryroot.com. That's HungryRoot.com.
Hi guys, I'm Jamie Oliver and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. How amazing. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and so much more. It's been 10 years, and they're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with David Tamarkin. And I always hate offering rules about cooking, like these are the steadfast ways you should eat and you should feed yourself and other people. But I've never come across something as exceptional as Cook 90, and I don't say this lightly, because I know so many people that adhere to diets, whether or not they're trends, fads, or you know, permanent facets of people's lives. This was more a challenge. This was less, you know, about the outcome than about what you were doing at the moment and how that made you feel mentally, physically, maybe even spiritually as well. And now there are 150,000 plus followers on this Cook 90 challenge. So I'm first going to let you explain why the hell you ever decided to cook three meals a day for 30 days, and then tease you a little bit about Skyline Chili.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, that is a very sweet thing to say, so thank you very much. Cook 90 is a 30-day challenge where you cook everything you eat. You cook every breakfast, every lunch, every dinner for a month-long period. You get three breaks in that period. That's why it's Cook 90 and not Cook 93. And I started doing it in January of 2016, and so I think of it as a January thing, though, of course, you could do it any time and you could start at any time, especially if you have the book or go to the website to get the parameters. I think a lot about why I started it, and I've written several stories about why I started it, and some of them conflict each other because the truth is there were many reasons. But it was genuinely a thing that I started and I thought I was just going to keep to myself. And I thought I was going to keep it to myself because at the time I was the editor of Epicurious, which, you know, which I still am. And I was sort of ashamed that I wasn't cooking more. You know, I was living alone in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I mean, there were so many opportunities to not cook, especially in a city. And I was working long hours. And I think initially I just wanted to understand my readers better. And I wanted to walk the walk that I was talking about, right? I was the editor of a cooking website where we do no restaurant coverage, no chef coverage. We just talk about home cooking. And certainly I was cooking. It's not like I was never cooking, but I just wanted to, I felt like I should be cooking more. And so that's one reason. And then there definitely was a mental health reason, which sounds really serious, but not serious, but it's a bit slightly serious. Just an anxiety thing. I just recognized around that time it was not the easiest time of my life, and I recognized, oh, when I'm standing at this countertop and my hand is on this, I had a very nice marble countertop at the time, and when my hand is, you know, I'm touching this countertop, and my other hand has a knife, and I'm cutting something, or whatever it is, just being in that space was very sort of centering to me. And I thought, well, you know, okay, this year was hard. Maybe next year will be less hard if I spend more time in this space, just standing here. So that was another part of it, which is the part that's not in the book and not in that I don't talk about very much.
Well, I'm first of all most impressed that you actually followed through with a New Year's resolution, because so many people talk about that. But I really do want to touch on this mental aspect again, because you do say in the book it's something that you did for physical reasons, for financial reasons, but I'm like triple underlying mental reasons. Mm-hmm. Not just to get into the psyche of your reader, but what did you come out understanding about yourself after cooking for yourself and feeding yourself and nourishing yourself for 30 days?
Yeah, there's definitely a self-care component to it. And there's also a lot of learning about what frustrates you and what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do and how you're willing to spend your time and not spend your time. And are you going to be the person that you say you are, that you think you are? Because when it's sort of like right now, I'm going to see if I can draw this parallel. Right now I'm working on a package for work that's all about plastic and reducing our use of single-use plastics. And it's been very interesting because I'm, you know, here I am again talking, a lot of talk, and then in my daily life I'm like noticing all the ways that I, you know, all the plastic I'm throwing away, all the plastic I'm consuming, all that, blah, blah, blah. So in this instance, you know, I was able to pull back and look at my life and look at how much I was cooking and how I was feeding myself and how I was treating myself and how much was I drinking when I was going out to restaurants and how much was I, you know, how much money was I spending and on restaurants and the cab back and what was I saying at these restaurants when I was drunk on a Tuesday night and, you know, on a date and was I making a fool of myself? You know, I mean, just, and did that fit with the person who I thought I was? And when you pull back and you, I kind of take all of that out of the equation, I'm like, oh, this is so interesting because I feel better and I feel more true to the idea of who I am. Or maybe it was just that I was feeling more like myself when I was cooking instead of going out. I was feeling more like myself when I was staying at home a little bit more. When I was, you know, just cooking with my boyfriend, or, you know, I realize I'm giving you cross message. I did have a boyfriend at the time, but I was also going on dates before that in that year. Anyway, I think there was sort of definitely a self-discovery thing because there's a lot of time spent by yourself, a lot of time, a lot of meditative time cooking if you live alone or if you cook alone, right? I mean, I understand for a lot of people, they're cooking with kids running around there. Maybe the kids are helping them, or maybe their partner's always there to help them, or their parents, or whatever it is. But for me, I was cooking a lot alone. And there's just a lot of time to think, a lot of downtime.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of your career has been helping others. And let me frame this in that you've always worked as a reporter and you've never been the subject yourself for CBS News Radio. You were a producer and director of research at Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Time Out Chicago as a food editor with Rick Bayless working on his cookbook and otherwise. When do you turn the lens on yourself and do you think more people in food media should be doing that or maybe are doing that? No, at the moment?
I think they need to stop. I feel like in a certain way, like I you don't have a choice if you're in media, any type of media anymore. You kind of have to make it about yourself. And I definitely am way more, here's another thing where I'm like, I say one thing and I do another. But the fact of the matter is, I would like to be someone who doesn't ever write in first person, but I feel most comfortable writing in first person, and that's what kind of just comes out of me most, right? So some of my career has been pushing against that, and sometimes I fall into it. I'm horrified that there are photos of me in this book. I'm horrified that my editors kind of pushed me to write about my personal experience and kind of write it in first person. I think it was the right decision because people, you know, people connect with other people, but I didn't want this book to be about me. I wanted it to be very, very removed from me. I wanted it to be something that anybody could connect to, and not everyone's going to connect to me. But that said, I think more I think when I think about where my career will go, where I would like it to go, I think I have to, like, and I don't know if, I think people, maybe you can relate to this. A lot of people can relate to this. I just have to, like, strip away a lot of the bullshit and strip away a lot of the layers of this is what I should do, this is what I should be doing, this is what a good person would do, this is what a good journalist would do, this is what a good careerist would do. I don't know if I really want to be any of those, but I just want to do what do I really want to do? Okay, well, let me take this back for 1 second. So we were just talking about book proposals before we started recording. So I have a list of book proposals that I want to work on that my agent has been waiting for. And I took them to my friend Julia Kramer, who I work with now. She's at Bon Appetit and I'm down the hall at Epi, and we worked together at Time Out Chicago. And I gave her all these ideas and she was like, these are fine, but like, I don't see you in any of them. And it really resonated with me because I do have a book proposal, and it's actually almost a book already, because I've already written it, that are more personal essays. Really weird fucking shit that I've never published and that I just did on my own and put away and pretended like it wasn't part of what I want to do, but actually is. So I'll go to that, and I think I will be going more first person because I think that's just, like I said, it's what's easiest and what seems to be in me.
I mean, but how do you parlay that into first-person food? And here's where I'm going to start teasing you about Skyline Chili. I mean, growing up in Cincinnati, what is the culinary legacy of that place other than this almost Mediterranean spiked meat sauce?
Wait, what? That
is the Skyline Chili I've had. Where are you coming from a food perspective? Like, what is your authority as someone from Cincinnati?
Yeah.
And then working their way through Chicago to be the one to say, this is how you cook, and this is how you feed yourself. In other words, just bash Skyline Chili as much as you want.
Right. No, I'm not going to bash Skyline Chili. So I got asked a lot when I was a restaurant critic in Chicago for 10 years. I got asked a lot, even by people who thought they were asking a kind question. What makes you qualified to do this? Which I always thought was sort of a rude question. But I thought about that a lot, and I thought, well, the answer is just breadth of experience. I don't think that my opinion on this plate of scallops in front of me is any worthier than anyone else's opinion, but I do think I can put it into context because I've been eating out 10 times a week for the past 7 years in Chicago. So breadth of experience, I think, is what gives people authority. And now, since I've been doing Cook 90 for, you know, this will be my fourth year, I do really feel I can speak from an authoritative place about what it takes to cook every day and to fit daily cooking or even just almost daily cooking into your life. But before that, I don't know. I wouldn't say that I had much authority at all. Like I didn't work in restaurants, which I know a lot of food writers did before they started, you know, writing about food. You know, I have a story which I'm a little embarrassed to. It's true though. My mom really was a great cook. And she kind of worked as a cook a little bit. She was in Cincinnati, where I grew up. Cincinnati Gas and Electric is the gas and electric company, and she was hired to teach people how to cook with food processors and blenders because the electric company wanted you to use those tools and use their.
Yeah, it's all about the
electricity,
grid.
Right. So she had a little cooking show on Public Access. Anyway, she was a little bit involved, but that was all before I was born, and we just had Bon Appetit and Gourmet around the house all the time. So I did kind of grow up with that. I think that was an influence, but it was mainly when I graduated from college and moved to New York. I was really homesick, and I bought my boyfriend at the time was working at Condé Nast, and he brought me home Gourmet magazine. I just like I felt it was sort of comforting. I hate that that's true. I hate that sounds so cheesy to me, but it's the truth. And I think I lied to get my first food writing jobs. I lied about my authority. I pinpointed Time Out New York as a place I wanted to write about because in 2000, Time Out New York was a great publication in New York Magazine. Adam Moss wasn't there yet. I mean, I felt like that they were doing the best work. And I wrote a restaurant review on spec, just a little 100-word capsule. But I took some friends out to a French restaurant in Fort Greene where I was living. It was nothing like Fort Greene now. I said, don't worry, guys, I've got this because I'm going to write this review and I'm going to sell this review and they're going to expense this meal for me, which of course did not happen. But I did send in the review and the editor said, hey, thanks, we don't need this, but we do need writers for our big, they used to put out these huge guides. I don't know if you remember that, but every year they would come out with a restaurant guide. $15 a pop. What cuisines are you fluent in? And I was like, I'm not fluent in anything. I thought that was just a silly question. I sort of do still. But I just said Caribbean. No. I said Middle Eastern and Jamaican. And she's like, oh, how do you know about Jamaican food? I said, well, I've done a little bit of traveling there, referring to like a, you know, vacation I'd taken when I was 12 to like a resort, you know, with my family. And then Middle East, and then she asked about Middle Eastern, and I said some lie. Anyway, and so I did those restaurants for 2 years. I just basically wrote those chapters of those books. I was probably an authority on it after those 2 years, but before that was a complete total lie and had no authority. So I just did it by hitting the ground.
I almost want to eliminate this word authority from the conversation, because there is a thing about empowerment that happens in this book that isn't coming from somebody that's of a higher level than someone who's hopefully cooking through this book. And I don't, you know, mean to say that as an insult.
It's true. I love that you noticed that.
Yeah. And I think it's such a ingratiating thing to see somebody right at a level that has a lot of latitude. And that's a hard thing to do. So you seem like somebody who sets parameters for themselves. how do you set parameters for recipes that go in this book? Aside from the, you know, 4-point plan, etc. Like, what does the collection of recipes in this book symbolize for you?
It was just very, they all had to be doable on a Wednesday night when you've worked during the day and you want to get into bed by 10 o'clock or 10:30. And I don't necessarily think that means that the recipe has to be fast. I think that means it has to be relatively, it can't be long, it can't be slow, but it doesn't have to be fast, because I do think, and I make this point in the book, I think there's this weird idea about all weeknight cooking or has to be fast, or there's this, we put fast cooking on a pedestal. But cooking itself can be what you do with your evening, right? And it can be an enjoyable process if we shift our thinking about it. And we think, okay, well, this recipe is going to take an hour, and I'm okay with that. That's how I'm going to spend my time tonight. And maybe it'll be by myself, or maybe it'll be with my partner or my kids. But this is a worthy activity that is worth time. I don't like the idea of like everything has to be fast, because why not spend time on cooking? Why not spend a Wednesday night, you know, on a braise that's going to take, you know, 30 minutes, as opposed to doing something quicker?
And as you show in this book, that time doesn't have to be relegated to that time. We'll talk about the phrase next over soon, but again, it isn't encapsulated within the actual active time you're cooking. It's how you activate it afterwards.
Yeah, you get on a cycle, and anybody who cooks a lot knows this. It's worth it to put it out into print for people who don't. But right, it's just using parts of one dish and using it again, and right, the time you put in on Wednesday night will save you time on a Thursday night. And then on balance, you'll probably spend, you know, if you average it out, maybe 30 minutes a night, but maybe that's because you spent 15 minutes one night and 45 minutes another. And all of that time is valuable. All of that time is good for you.
I will say I was intimidated by reading that this is an exercise in high-intensity interval cooking.
Oh,
that's like going to the gym and saying that you're going to do like lunges and squats for
Right, it's based on high intensity interval training.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, but I love that term, and I wish I had. I kind of the other day I was thinking, oh, I should have named the book that. I should have named Cook 90 HIIC, which I guess maybe it's not a good idea if it's intimidating. But I love that because it gets to the point of why do it? Why do a challenge? Why make this a challenge? Why not just say, hey, we should all be cooking a little bit more, and here are some recipes that you can do that. the reason for doing a challenge is because you do it and it is intense, and you find out so much more about yourself when you really force yourself, when you box yourself in with these parameters, like you say. At least that's, as you pointed out, that's how I like to do things, and I have lots of other ways that I do it in my life. But I think it's, I have found it useful.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break and come back and actually put ourselves to the Cook 90 Challenge. You've been listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back. Today's program was brought to you by Hunger Root. I have to say, I'm quite impressed by Hunger Root's simplicity, and I know you will be too. Though I've worked in restaurants for years, I love the ease of going online, selecting from a variety of wholesome foods. With the click of a button, you have a personalized pantry made just for you. It's like having your own set of sous chefs. You can make meals from their fresh-cut vegetables like beet noodles, broccoli rice, and super blend salads. And add in proteins like savory spiced tofu bites, sweet barbecue chili jackfruit, and new as of 2019, Hunger Root has introduced two kinds of chicken sausage and even a hot smoked salmon option. Mix these morsels together as you please over salads or rice and grains, and toss them together with tasty sauces like Thai peanut, kale pesto, or dairy-free garlic parm. I personally love the whole wheat sprouted flatbread, which I made into a crunchy white pie with creamy garlic parm and topped with roasted broccoli rice, a meal I've eaten twice in the same amount of days. Delivered right to your door, Hunger Root is full of fiber, protein, complex carbohydrates, and all the vitamins and minerals you need to feel great. Tailored to your diet or individual tastes, your Hunger Root experience can be vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, or whatever you're craving. And don't worry, there are sweets too. With no preservatives, artificial ingredients, refined sugars, trans fats, or additives to speak of, it's a complete meal that's completely delicious. If you're interested in bringing Hunger Root into your life, start by getting $25 off two deliveries. That's $50 in savings by visiting hungerroot.com/foodscene. That's HungerRoot.com/FOODSEEN. Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with David Tamarkin and Cook 90. And let's just talk about this hashtag for a second, Cook 90, the number 90, and the fact that there are over 150,000 people following and actively participating in this challenge itself. I'm not much of a rules person, but I admire people that can abide by rules and understand the parameters of these things. And, you know, we can go through the four-point plan, which are smart meal planning, a big shop, speed pantry, and the last one are nextovers, which I employ the idea of nextovers every day of my life. That seems simple. Four little things. And it seems like most people actually at least do one of those things inherently. Mm-hmm. Did you before you took this challenge upon yourself?
I think I probably did the shopping one. Like I'm a big fan of online grocery shopping, and I would do it, you know, put in a big order, and so I would be stocked up for the week. I like going to the grocery store, but I do think it's a time suck, and I like to kind of get that off my plate. But I definitely wasn't meal planning. I think my pantry could have been a little bit better before I started. And nextovering I was doing, no, I was not doing, because the difference between nextovers and leftovers is that you do nextovers with intention. So that, you know, was I cooking, if I had some potatoes in the fridge left over, would I put those in a, you know, or tortilla or whatever? Yeah, I would do that. But that's just using leftovers. So that's the main difference between leftovers and nextovers. Nextovers, of course, is when you, of course, because everyone knows what nextovers is, when you're cooking potatoes, you throw in a few extra knowing that you're going to use the potatoes another night in a completely different dish.
There are these, I don't know how many pages it is, but there are these schematics of how to meal plan in this book. And I'll leave that for people to see for themselves, because at first it does look a little intimidating with, you know, the arrows going one way or another. And it kind of looks like a football play. But really it's so linear. And it's what we do unintentionally most of the time. Yeah. Cook too much or don't know what to do with an ingredient, that it's nice to have that preemptively done. And then I am a speed pantry guy, even though I have an exhaustive, intense pantry things from around the world. And it's actually...
The vinegars in your pantry must be... It must be the best vinegar pantry in the world.
It was when it was over 500 bottles. And now it's...
My God.
Yeah, now it's a few dozen.
That's like a cellar, not a pantry. Like a,
you could
like
it
a
took wine over cell. My wife's wine fridge.
Wow.
Yeah, it was that was a point of contention. We could talk about that later. But having a pantry that doesn't have to be extensive and can be so easy and active, tell me why diamond crystal salt alone makes somebody a better cook.
Because I think you can just control your seasoning better. And it wasn't until I started cooking with diamond kosher crystal that I really felt like I understood how to season intuitively. And it's so easy to over-season with table salt, which is what I think a lot of people are using, and which is why I insisted in this book to call specifically for kosher salt. And even in the recipe directions, you know, put in the half teaspoon kosher salt, because I really want people to know if you're not using kosher salt, this is not correct.
Yeah.
I feel like it's much more forgiving and you can add a lot of it, you can add it with gusto and not be fucked.
Yeah.
And learn from that and keep on learning from that. Because you're doing it with table sauce and you kind of be like, okay, I'm going to really season this motherfucker. I'm going to like put all this, then it's ruined and you'll never try it again. Right.
I feel like you stock your pantry with a lot of those kind of flavor bombs or enhancers. And a lot of them are canned. Beans, yes. Tomatoes, even tuna. Have that at the ready at all times.
Yeah.
How do you take that out of the context of lazy and make that, you know, something exciting for someone to cook with?
Yeah. That's funny. Lazy, because the alternative for tuna would be...
I'm not
cooking
saying,
it and then conserving it.
Or going like pole, catching it. Yeah, yeah, yes, going right, through that whole right. process.
I don't know. I think a lot of people have this stuff in their cabinet, but they don't. I'm thinking of my sisters right now who are my benchmarks for typical home cooks. I think they have this stuff in their cabinets, but they don't know what to do with it besides take the tuna out, mix it with mayonnaise and make a tuna sandwich, which of course is a perfectly great thing to do. I don't think they would ever think of putting it in pasta. I don't think they would think to, put it in what else can you do with tuna, Michael? I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
Put in your margarita.
Well, let's stop at pasta for a second, because I think that was one of the best ways to kind of introduce the recipes in the book, to just say, here are spaghettis 1 through 3. And those spaghettis 1 through 3, the first one's anchovy garlic breadcrumbs, the mm-hmm. second's white beans and harissa mm-hmm. With dill, and the third one's tuna and lemon.
Yeah.
All three things have canned items in them.
Right.
And they're three distinctly different recipes.
Yeah, they're all pantry pastas, which I think is like... To me, pasta is a last resort. I mean, I love pasta. I love pasta too much. I don't. This is where things get a little complicated for me, because I think it's fine if you want to eat pasta every night, and I think it should be. I think I should feel fine if I want to eat pasta every night. But I did, just for me personally, I don't want to put a judgment on pasta. It's really hard to talk about food and cooking, especially this book, without and walk around the. What I'm saying is, I think it's a minefield, because there are so many different ways I could put my foot in my mouth and say something I don't mean, and say something that seems judgmental about the way people cook. And I'm very adamant that I don't even think you have to cook. I don't think cooking is a moral activity. I don't think it makes you a better person. If you don't like to cook, fine. And I wanted to put something in this book about that. And my editor was like, you know what? There's a certain point where you just have to assume that if they pick up this book, they want to cook, which I think is a good point. But anyway, so what I'm saying is, for me, I know myself, I don't want to eat pasta every night. But I love having it around for when I get home and I just don't know what to cook, or I just don't want to cook what I planned. I just don't have time, whatever. I think it's a... And so to me, pasta is a pantry thing. It's not something that I would necessarily plan out. It's like a last minute thing. So to have it all from cans and bottles is really crucial.
And not to jump way ahead to a next over, a recipe later on in the book is a pesto pasta frittata. So pasta is also a frittata.
I love that. You've seen a pasta frittata before?
Yes.
Yeah. But a lot of people haven't. And I love that. I mean, that's sort of a mind-blowing idea for a lot of people. What? I can put pasta in my eggs and eat it for breakfast, and it's good? And it really is good. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about to do with a pesto pasta, is to use it the next morning. That's the type of thing that I really am excited about. Like, for the people like my sisters who just aren't thinking that way. I just wanted to click for them. I wanted to click that is so easy, right? If you have leftover pasta in your fridge and you need to make breakfast for yourself or your family, it's right there, and it connects to the meal you made before, and it's just and that's when it would start to click for someone. Oh, this is how the cooking cycle works, and this is how easy it can be.
I thought the most interesting part of this book for me was the indices. It's a weird thing to say that, like, I'm actually looking at the back of the book and, you know, checking to see what kind of recipes you have in it. But in reading the book from, you know, cover to cover, I saw these callbacks, these tropes, be it, you know, eggs or rice or chicken, and trying to figure out how you would organize that in the back in a way that people would realize how often they pop up. But how iterant they are as well. So where do you go from teaching somebody how to make a 7-minute egg, and where else does that egg end up throughout the book?
I mean, God, I think there's so many eggs. I was looking at my Instagram feed the other day. I was like, I need to stop putting eggs on my Instagram feed.
No, you don't.
But as somebody who doesn't eat, I definitely eat meat, but I don't eat a ton of it. It's like such a good source of protein. And readers can't see me, but I'm so swole. I'm so muscular. I need protein all the time. I'm actually like, look like a scarecrow, and that's why I need protein, so I don't fall over. The 7-minute egg is really, I'm really passionate about how to make a 7-minute egg. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, especially, I'll just call them out, on the New York Times about how to make a proper 7-minute egg. I think they're completely wrong. I think it's a horrible idea to start an egg in cold water. You lose so much control that way. So that's like one of the longest head notes in the book, is how to make the 7-minute egg. And then it pops up all over. It pops up, definitely in salads. I love this like bacon and egg salad, which is basically another kind of improvised thing, like from your fridge. Yeah.
I also love that you call it breakfast salad.
Yeah, it's a breakfast salad for breakfast, or when you eat breakfast for dinner or whatever. And, you could definitely put it in any soup. There's definitely an egg salad recipe in there that you just put in a jar and bring to work. There is, I don't know, I don't have the index in front of me. Do you?
I mean, I love the green egg salad jars, which I think you were referring to.
Yeah,
even though it's a fried egg, just the greens and grains with a fried egg.
Right. Yeah.
There are so many ideas of eggs in here, in the same way that there are rice and chickens, that you have a recipe called a big pot of rice.
Mm-hmm.
You have a recipe called rotisserie chicken. And then you see both of those things converge in something like mojo chicken with rice and beans.
Yeah, right.
You have the parts.
Right. You do have the parts, yeah. And I wanted to talk about the rotisserie chicken for a second.
Yes.
Because I want people to understand that the rotisserie chicken, there's not a recipe for rotisserie chicken. There are 6 recipes about how to use a rotisserie chicken. And these recipes are from my coworker, Anna Stockwell, who did this on the site, and we put it in the book. I think it's a really empowering idea to think of a rotisserie chicken in the same way that we would a can of tuna or a package of tofu. It's a protein that you can buy and cook with. It's not weak or lazy to buy a rotisserie chicken and bring it home, as long as, well, it's not weak or lazy to buy it in any sense, but for the purposes of Cook 90, it's completely allowed, because there are so many things you can do with a rotisserie chicken. And you really, if you wanted rotisserie chicken to taste good, you really should do something with it, because most of them are really dried out and have lost their flavor. But that's to me, when that idea was presented to me as the editor of Epicurious, I was so excited. I was like, yes, this is an empowering idea. This is sort of a game changing idea for a lot of people who have bad feelings about themselves, about how much they cook, or feel guilty when they pick up a rotisserie chicken for their family. I don't think that, or for people who are like, why does rotisserie chicken taste bad? Why can't I take advantage of this rotisserie at my grocery store?
It seems like it tastes much better in a green curry with bell peppers, sugar, snap peas.
Yeah, or you just add some liquid back to it. Like, they're so dried out, you just braise it in some tomatoes and some wine, and you're good.
But you also empower people by showing them how to cook slow-cooked chicken, shredded chicken, quick tiki masalas, make sesame chicken with broccoli. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not saying that this is a pantry ingredient because you can't do it better than this. Just like in a pinch, don't feel bad that you go out and get this protein.
Absolutely. I would never, right. Don't feel bad about anything, but definitely look at what's on offer to you. There's so much on offer to us right now, and how can we use it in our meals and cook with it instead of just sort of like eating it as is.
Now, do you feel bad or do you take the 3 breaks you allow readers?
Absolutely. Yeah. I definitely take them. I go crazy at about day 18.
Yeah.
Like I wake up, I'm like, I just cannot be in my kitchen again. And I will organize this year. I always say at the beginning of the month, I'm going to like organize a bunch of cooking dates, you know, with my friends. They will either come over or I'll go over there. But it's January, right? In the north, it's like cold, it's dark. People don't want to travel to Harlem where I live. You know, they're all here in like fucking Bushwick. and sometimes it doesn't work out. But I go crazy and I get a little resentful and I wonder why I'm doing it. But so that's a good time to take a break. But then also, honestly, and again, this sounds so cheesy and not real, but it really is. When I am feeling agitated, no matter what, if I'm doing Cook 90 or not, I do truly find the act of cooking makes me feel better. And I know that's not the case for everybody, but it's definitely the case with me. And if I can just like get through my annoyance and get to the kitchen, get to the stove, then I can be fine.
I know you say not to cook anything twice in the book during this, you know, month-long process, but you had me at grilled chocolate sandwiches with jam.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things is you say in the pantry, always have a good chocolate bar. And I thought it was just a snack thing. Mm-hmm. But it turns into this decadent but delicious recipe.
And there's a sandwich which I really I mean, that's really all I want to eat is carbs and butter and chocolate all the time.
That's all I've eaten leading up to this interview today.
Casey and I. You can also turn the chocolate into like these little shots of chocolate that I think is a really good weeknight dessert, because I'm not going to like bake a cake on a weeknight, but you know, melt some chocolate and put some bourbon in it. That's just a grilled cheese with chocolate, shredded chocolate instead of cheese, and then some jam for a little acidity, and that's it. And you could leave out the jam if you wanted to. It just go all like fat. I hope people make that. I hope people allow themselves to make it. It'd be a really good breakfast too.
Yeah. I hope people take chocolate shots as well.
Yeah.
But you also say that snacking is allowed. Only if you add in a butternut squash. Because I'm a big cheese and crackers person. I'm like, wait, what are you saying about cheese and crackers? That this isn't a meal?
You're right. Well, right. I think snacking between meals is allowed. Because what are you going to do? I mean, like, I don't know. I just think this is not supposed to be a punishment, right? It's supposed to be something that it's definitely a challenge. It can get hard, but it's not supposed to like. I'm not going to tell people they can't snack between meals and deprive themselves of their almonds or their apple or their chocolate, whatever it is. But I do love. But about the soup. So you're referring to a recipe of butternut squash soup with cheese and crackers, and what that's about is. I was struggling with something that I think, you tell me, Michael, a lot of cookbook writers struggle with. Was like, I have this recipe. I like it. It seems so basic. I have to do something else to it. You know, we have this idea that we can't just put like a basic butternut squash soup in there. And so I was talking to my social media editor, Epi. I was like, what are you putting in your soup? What are you putting in your butternut squash soup? She's like, I only eat soup with cheese and crackers. I was like, that's a great idea. And so... That's why I spiced the recipe up.
Yeah.
Just that one little thing. But I do love the idea, and I think it's a sort of a really good solo cooking thing. Just cheese, crackers, soup, Netflix. You're gone. You're good. What did I say? You're gone.
it's been a long 30-day challenge. But, you know, I want to reinforce that even though the word challenge is associated with Cook 90, it feels less that than it feels like a community almost with those 150,000, you know, Instagram followers. With those 3 cheat days, which I feel like people can reach out to you and you can cook for them. Maybe.
Yeah, for sure.
Put together a big potluck of a lot of cook 90 people together. So they realize it's not really cooking alone. It's not really cooking for one. Mm-hmm. It's cooking to bring you back into a greater spectrum of people.
Yeah. And that's one of the coolest things about Cook 90 has been watching people use the hashtag and seeing them comment on each other's posts. And the feedback I get from them is that they feel connected to other home cooks around the country, which is really a wonderful thing. And absolutely. And this year on Epi, we made a big push to say, okay, this year do a Cook 90 club, like do it with other people, because it might be easier that way. It certainly is isolating for people who live alone and are single to do Cook 90 because, it's a lot of time in your house where you're not going out and getting drinks. And you can certainly fit drinks in, but there is a point where you might start to feel lonely, and certainly cooking is going to be more fun for a lot of people if it's with other people. So I think that's a really good way to go. I'm going to form my own Cook 90 club with, or rather...
Tell me.
Well, there are some people who I have not asked yet to do Cook 90 with me, but they live in my neighborhood, and they're just random Cook 90ers who I haven't met. And I'm like, well, maybe we can just one night have a chocolate sandwich, and hopefully you won't think I'm like hitting on you.
Yeah. We'll be watching out for that. We'll be following that hashtag Cook90 for sure.
Cook 90 date.
Yeah. Thank you, David, so much, not only for coming on the show, but for presenting a challenge that I think is something that a lot of people can accomplish and feel good about accomplishing.
Thank you.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Big thank you to our sponsor, Music by Cookies, and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.